This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And the big news is that the province has lowered the age for colorectal cancer screening to 45 from 50. Now, this comes in the wake of a notable increase in the number of younger people diagnosed with the disease and advocacy from the Canadian Cancer Society and other organizations. But if you'll recall, the first time we talked about this proposal with our panel of very experienced physicians, the consensus was that this was not necessarily a good use of limited health resources because the numbers were still small of younger people being diagnosed, and because there are always false positives, false negatives when it comes to screening like this and the anxiety that goes along with it. We'll also talk about that disturbing hantavirus outbreak on a cruise ship, especially disturbing since so many in our demographic really like cruising. And it does remind us of what happened at the beginning of the pandemic. There's also an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease here in Toronto that public health is investigating. But I want to begin with a very bizarre crime caper. So the ceremonial bell that patients use to mark and celebrate the end of their cancer treatment was stolen from the Waterloo Regional Cancer Center. A 44-year-old man was arrested. The bell was recovered and it's been reinstalled. Now, nobody on the panel is a psychologist, but I'm sure there is a lot of psychology behind this and we'll get into it. The numbers to call people, 866-740-4740 is our text line, and our long-distance phone line, 416-360-0740, is our local phone line.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret and former head of BC Cancer, Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto, and Dr. Barry Pacus, a professor at the University of Toronto's Dalhousie School of Public Health and a former medical officer of health of York Region. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello.
Hi, Libby.
Hi. So, Malcolm, what do you think is this? To me, this was bizarre. Those bells to mark the end of cancer treatment are very meaningful for a lot of patients and their families. So who would steal it? There was an actual arrest and the bell was recovered. Do you have any thoughts on this thing?
Well, so this idea came some years ago that when people finish their chemotherapy, they ring a bell. And as you say, for the person, it's very meaningful. The bells are usually in or around the chemotherapy unit. There is actually some differences of opinion about this. And whether this influenced the person who stole the bell, I don't know, because there's no particular value to the bell. But there are some people who feel that it's difficult for people. There are people in the chemotherapy unit who will never finish their chemotherapy because they have incurable cancers and they're always going to be facing the diagnosis of cancer and the treatment associated with that. So there is a point of view that this can be very difficult for people who are sitting in the chemotherapy unit knowing they'll never get to ring the bell. Again, whether this influenced this particular individual to do this, I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, I mean, I found not only the theft bizarre, but actually arresting someone because, it doesn't sound like the usual kind of crime. Alisa, do you have patients who find this very meaningful?
I'm sort of in shock that somebody would go and take a bell. But maybe as Malcolm says, that there's some people who feel that if you can't, if you're going to be continuing on treatment, that maybe it's actually detrimental to people's well-being. I think that everybody finds it, and it's often advertised in part of campaigns, the significance of the bell. So it's very unfortunate as to the reason that somebody would go in to take it. So I guess it's just another example within our society of strange things that happen and what happened along the way to all of us.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that I was really looking forward to ringing the bell after my first cancer treatment. And my usual favorite chemo nurse said, don't do it. It's not for you because I have a mutation. So I didn't do it. But I can see how people who do not have a hope of ending it, ending their treatment, can be kind of jealous, Barry.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have personal experience with it, but most certainly, it creates a challenging dynamic. It's very meaningful for some and hurtful for others. And you know, as a public health person, a person concerned with not only the individual patient, but the whole community and the social meaning of this, you know, it's a reasonable thing to debate. You know, none of us have any idea why this person would have stolen it. And there's no question that that's the wrong thing to do. It's the right thing to do is to have conversations about it within the hospital, within the unit, and each person will make their own decision. Each hospital will figure out over time what makes sense.
Okay, well, speaking of public health, so the province has lowered the screening age for colorectal cancer. The original ask was to lower it to 40. It's been lowered from 50 to 45. And Malcolm, I recall conversations where the consensus here on this panel was that maybe this wasn't a good use of our resources.
You know, Libby, okay, I'm going to get state a position or an opinion on this and admit a bias. Right now in my practice, I have a number of patients under 50 with advanced colon cancer. And, you know, advanced colon cancer, which is ultimately fatal, is a tragedy for anyone. But for people in their 40s and early 50s, they're in a stage of life. They have young children still in school. They have a lot of their life ahead of them. It's particularly heart-wrenching to see that. So I think that, you know, there's nothing magical about this previous cutoff of 50. It's not like the incidence rapidly ramps up at 50. In fact, and as we've heard, the incidence is going up in people in their 40s for reasons we don't know. So I also think public health point of view, I like to see money invested in keeping people healthy as opposed to spending tons of money on these very expensive drugs to try and keep people who already have advanced cancer. So I think it's a good thing. The cynic in me says, what has the government actually said? And I think what they've actually said from a policy point of view is that they're now going to fund fit tests for people between the age of 45 and 50. But if you do that, you're going to increase the demand on the colonoscopy system because many of those are going to be positive, many will be false positive. So you have to build the capacity for colonoscopy. So if you just make an announcement that you're funding the fit test, but at the same time you're cutting back on the hospitals where the actual colonoscopies are provided, then you know you're not really fully funding screening for people between 45 and 50. And that level of detail was not in the announcement.
Another question. On American television, I keep seeing ads for a blood test as opposed to the FIT test, which is a stool test. Do you know about that, Malcolm?
Well, that's where the field is going. So we've talked a little bit about this before, about what's called ctDNA, which is circulating tumor DNA. Cancer has mutations in it, and we now have technologies that can detect very small amounts of these mutations in the blood of patients. So that's where the whole field of cancer screening is going, to try and detect cancer at these very microscopic levels, because the impact of that is likely to be much greater. So we're not there yet, but that's where we're going.
Barry, Dr. Pacus, so from a public health point of view, what do you think of lowering the age for colorectal screening?
So, you know, as Dr. Moore mentioned, everything is dependent on these decisions are often through public pressure, and there's no question that young people getting colon cancer, which in theory should be preventable, is tragic. But, you know, we do need to think about the entire system, and it's not just about putting more money into the system, which we're already not doing, but, you know, as was mentioned, the gastroenterologists or the general surgeons who do those scopes, the vast majority, first of all, the vast majority of people who are between 45 and 50 who are offered the FIT test, just like people who are over 50, are not going to do that test. So it's a minority of people who will do that test. And then a very small minority of those people who do the test and it's positive will actually have a positive finding. So it's a lot of resources and work, and dependent on the individual and the family doctor to do that testing to prevent one case. And, you know, if you're the person whose case is prevented, which, of course, you'll never know because it's prevented, then you're going to be greatly appreciative, and it makes good sense, and saving one life will be worth it. But, you know, we need to look at the big picture with any screening test, whether that's prostate or breast. There's a new abdominal aortic aneurysm, sort of where the big blood vessel in your body that can theoretically burst, and you can screen for that also. There's many different tests, screening tests. We need to think it all through and figure out, does it make sense in our system that is already strained far beyond capacity to be able to do all those other things, not just the test itself, but all those other things that relate to it? The answer may be yes, but it all needs to be very well thought out and planned and equitable. Again, most of the people who are offered these tests, including, you know, even breast screening, higher rates of people do that, but not everybody does that. We need an actual system outside of primary care, in my personal opinion, that manages all of this screening, you know, right from the beginning to the end, so that we can actually manage it in the most efficient way possible.
So when you say that most people offered this test because it's a home test, are not going to take it. Elisa, do your patients take it? I mean, it's a pain in the you know what.
I'm sitting here going, those aren't my patients. My patients are anxious, wanting every single test possible. So I have a population of patients who are generally well-informed in terms of what screening is required, and they'll come in and specifically ask. I think a lot of people now know that rates of colorectal cancer is increasing in younger people, and people will come in and want the test. So up until just recently, this conversation would happen at 50, that with patients that it would be, oh, it's your time, like it's time we need to do some type of colorectal screening. What would you like to do? Would you like to do a FIT test, which is what the guideline says, or as I deviate from the guideline and offer people a colonoscopy? And there's two different types of people. There's people who just want to go and get a colonoscopy. They want to be reassured and they don't want to worry about it if it's clean for 10 years. And other people who hate the thought of ever going for a colonoscopy and are just happy to just continue to do FIT tests on every 2 years. I think the other, so, and then from the perspective of like the system, my perspective is actually different. I take the approach of, I have a person sitting in front of me who I know we have a relationship with, and we have a conversation, and it becomes hard for me to, you know, screening tests on a population level, but I'm dealing with somebody on an individual level, and often that perspective is different than what the system and how things should operate. I would say that the other thing that this announcement does do is, so now at the age of 50, you would be allowed to, you could get a FIT test without coming to see a primary care provider. And that age is now lowering to 45. So that's the same thing that happened with breast cancer screening, that until last year, if you didn't have a family doctor or primary care provider, you weren't able to access a screening mammography until you were 50, and now that's been lowered to 40. So maybe some of this is at play, is that people don't have access to care and you're able to go and to directly order their test yourself. So we'll see. But I generally will have people will at least agree to do a fit test. The colonoscopy can sometimes be the harder test, but most often people will agree to do the test at home.
Moving along, so there's this outbreak of Legionnaire's disease, Barry, and there didn't seem to be much detail. Where is it? How did it happen? What can you tell us?
Yeah, so you know, it's fun that two of the topics today are one is Legionnaire's disease and the other one is hantavirus disease. Yeah. Both of these are, you know, diseases that affect the lungs, and but very different diseases. So Legionnaires is named after the Legion Hall where it was first found in the 70s, and it is a bacteria that is really happy between sort of 30 degrees and 50 degrees Celsius. So it doesn't live in the cold, it doesn't like the hot, and so it hangs out in water, most often in cooling towers or decorative fountains, and sometimes in water systems inside buildings. So, you know, we don't know oftentimes, and this happens from time to time, we don't know why there is this cluster of cases. And by cluster, we mean they seem to have occurred generally in the same area geographically. What that often means in the past is that it's from a cooling tower. And a cooling tower on top of building with water that's of a particular temperature in a particular season, and it gets aerosolized, meaning it, you know, it spreads through those water droplets. And people just, you know, out in the community will get it. Most people will not get sick. Again, like so many things, it's those who are elderly or immunocompromised who can potentially get very sick. And we have 9 cases in this case. But, you know, sometimes it's really hard to find. And the reason is we don't know where all these cooling towers are. And actually, in public health, we do some really incredible investigative work with geographic systems. We're mapping out the cooling towers. It's hard to do. Sometimes, you know, previously when I was involved, it involved looking on, you know, Google Earth, where are these cooling towers? In some places like Quebec, you actually have to register the cooling towers so we know where they are, and it's a little bit easier to figure this out. But I'm saying it's early days. It's early days in that it's being, you know, we're finding out about it now. This has been going on since March, but it's just very hard to figure out where it's coming from. The good news with this one is that it is easy to treat. As long as you identify it correctly, and a lot of that depends on doctors sort of, you know, testing for it, a simple antibiotic can often treat for it. But, you know, people do pass away, and there was a very large outbreak I was involved with very early in my training 25 years ago at an old folks home where actually 23 people died and 150 people were sick. And so it can be potentially serious. And public health, Toronto Public Health is doing great work, doing their best to figure out where this is coming from. It's often a difficult mystery to solve.
And do you know where in the city, like it said, southeast, do you know where it is?
So I don't, you know, personally know where it is and where the people are that are suffering from it. Often has just as much to do with wind and which way things are going. And of course, you know, public health doesn't want to unnecessarily alarm people, because you're going to have every person in that area say, oh my goodness, I've got a little bit of a cough, I need to go in and get antibiotics or go get seen. And that would be understandable from those people's perspectives. But, you know, we don't know enough about it to know, you know, exactly where it is. And there is a very minimal risk to the population overall, not zero, but very minimal risk. So it's not something that I think people need to really worry about, but it's something, you know, that public health will continue to investigate. And when they know something that's relevant, 100% they will share it.
Okay, so on to the hantavirus. And we first heard about the hantavirus because that was what killed Gene Hackman's wife and ultimately him, because she died and couldn't take care of him. Three people on a cruise ship died. The one thing they tell you about this hantavirus, which is passed by rodents, they say it's not passed by human-to-human contact. Now suddenly they're saying, well, maybe it was passed by human-to-human contact. I think that some of the people have been evacuated from the ship, but it wasn't allowed to dock. People were stuck on the ship. It was all Very upsetting. And it brought to mind what happened at the beginning of the pandemic, Malcolm.
No, this is different. So first of all, hantavirus is not one virus. It's about 40 different. There's about 40 different hantaviruses. And all of it is from, if humans get it, they typically get it from the feces of rats or mice. So if there's one thing for our listeners to take home is, if you go into some place in your house where there's a lot of mouse poo, and you decide you're going to clean it out, at the very least, wear a mask. Because if you get hantavirus, it is often fatal and there aren't good treatments. But this is not, as far as we know, a communicable disease. So it's very likely that the three people on the boat, or the seven, however many have this, were exposed to this probably when they went ashore to somewhere in Argentina. And so it's more of a group of people who've been exposed to this. So what you don't see in the cruise ship is you don't see this thing running through the entire ship the way COVID did, you know, on that particular cruise ship 6 years ago. But, you know, this is a bit frightening, but it's rare. In Canada, I think there are probably less than 10 cases of hantavirus a year. I'm actually quite curious how they made the diagnosis on a cruise ship, whether I'm surprised they had the diagnostic methodology to make such a rare diagnosis. But anyways, I think we will find out once this is investigated, how these people were exposed and how it was transmitted.
Alisa, have people been asking you about it? You're muted. Alisa, you're muted. You're muted.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. I think that it's nobody's come in yet, but because the story sort of just developed over the weekend. But generally, when outbreaks happen on cruises, people will come in because, as you mentioned, a lot of people take cruises, especially now. And I think you really do have to be careful. I think this is an extraordinary case. And actually, I did read that the doctor who was treating them on the ship was actually became ill. And had to be, and people were medically evacuated off of the ship. You can see pictures of that. But it's one of the things is that this is thought to be maybe a different strain of the hantavirus than anti-strain, where it is considered that there could be human-to-human transmission and within this strain. And it was a couple that got sick first, and it's felt that they maybe got it offshore. And then there's an additional individual on the ship who got sick, who they haven't explained how the connection is with the couple who actually passed away. But the biggest thing that when we talk about with people going on a cruise is, one is other respiratory illnesses. And as you mentioned, way back in when the pandemic first started in 2020, there was like 1,000 people got sick on the Sun Princess in Japan. And then people had to be brought back and had to be put into quarantine in Canada. But on a typical basis, the one thing that we talk about is foodborne. And so norovirus would be the most common one, and how people should take precautions in terms of washing your hands because it is common from time to time that there will be outbreaks of norovirus that will happen on cruise ships.
Yeah. You're nodding your head, Barry.
Yeah, hantavirus is one of those things we learn in medical school and certainly in public health training that is mostly from rodent droppings and actually classically, farmers who going across the fields with their combines and chopping up rats and they breathe them in. That's one of the fun things that you learn is how, you know, it's communicated sometimes. But in the Andes version, which is what's going on here, can be communicated to others with very close contact, which is what it sounds like with those three individuals that passed away and the other five or six people who it looks like are also ill. Not 100% sure how they got it, but you know, one person would have gotten it on shore and with very close contact, it looks like that's how they may have got it. And it is a very, dangerous virus. 40 to 50% of people do get very, very ill and often succumb to it. So, cruises, I've never been on one. I'm a public health doctor, so not likely to go on this kind of cruise ever. But it's something I don't think people need to worry about, hantavirus. You know, there are other things, respiratory viruses and GI viruses that do happen. And the most common thing that harms people is actually your regular old, getting a heart attack when 5,000 people are on a large ship. It's bound to happen there. But, people shouldn't be worried about it, particularly this. It's more of interest to folks that when you're doing something remote like this and unusual, there are very, very rare risks that do happen.
And how is it treated if it's treatable?
It's supportive care. It, like many things, it's supportive care in the ICU, making sure, if you're not breathing well, you get a breathing tube to help you breathe. If you're inflammation, they often give you steroids, but there are not specific antiviral treatments at this time that will help people. Your body needs to take care of it yourself. If the supportive care can manage to get people through that little hump, then people will survive. And sometimes that doesn't happen.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Very interesting and great information. Thank you so much, Dr. Barry Pakis, Dr. Malcolm Moore, and Dr. Alisa Naiman. And we'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
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 Okay. People, we are taking a short break. When we come back, so our next Governor General was named Louise R. Brewer. And she's a very accomplished woman, but there is a lot of criticism on the right, on the left of this appointment, and we'll delve into that when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, there is no doubt that she is a hugely accomplished woman. But there is criticism on both the right and the left of the appointment of Louise R. Brewer as our next governor general. On the left, Democracy Watch is criticizing the Liberal Prime Minister Mark Carney for personally handpicking the new governor general in a secretive and partisan process. Now, on the right, the critique is that she fits the stereotype of a Laurentian elite liberal insider with politically correct progressive views. Now, the appointment, though, is definitely striking a blow against ageism. Our current Governor General, Mary Simon, was in her early 70s when she was appointed. Louise R. Brewer is 79, and she is embarking on a five-year term, and it's hard to argue with that. So, the numbers to call, what do you think? It is 866-740-4740. That is our text line and our long-distance phone line. 416-360-0740. That's our local phone line. And now I would like to welcome Duff Conacher's co-founder of Democracy Watch, and Peter DiNolo, former director of communications to Prime Minister Jean Chrétien. Hello, and welcome to you both.
Hi there.
Thank you.
Okay, let's begin with Duff Conacher. So, and before we start, I'd like to remind people that the last time a prime minister totally oversaw and handpicked a governor general, it resulted in the disastrous term of Julie Payette. So, Duff, go ahead. What are your issues with this?
Yeah, just to say, first of all, Democracy Watch is not a left group. We're nonpartisan. We criticize parties across the political spectrum, from the Conservatives to the NDP. And we're not criticizing Louise R. Brewer, the person who's been appointed. It's about the process. As the Prime Minister said himself, Prime Minister Carney said himself yesterday, the Governor General is the guardian of our constitutional order and makes several very important legal decisions concerning prorogations, snap election calls, what is a vote of confidence in the House of Commons, and as a result should not be chosen by the ruling party prime minister only. It should be a multi-partisan democratic process. We have a proposal that would also make the Governor General more Canadian and more legitimately a representative and guardian of our democracy by having party leaders across the country choose the Governor General from a short list that an independent committee would come up with. But the key thing is this person needs to be seen as nonpartisan and impartial. And when you have the ruling party PM handpicking the person, that taints the position with partisanship. And it's very dangerous to have that position tainted with partisanship. It undermines the public's confidence in the position. And it's a very important law enforcement position. And like all law enforcement positions, like all officers of parliament, guardians of our democracy, they should be chosen in a democratic, multi-partisan way that or non-partisan independent way, not chosen by the ruling party PM who they watch over.
Justin Trudeau started this panel after the Julie Payette fiasco, but it was considered to be a bit of a sham, Peter.
Well, actually, Stephen Harper, to give credit where it's due, actually put in place a panel when he made his governor general choices. And John Fraser, who's written, by the way, an excellent book called The Governor's General, about all 13 governors general that were born in Canada since 1952, was served on that committee. And he writes in the book about how he effectively thought it was. So, you know, whether it's a committee or not, or whatever judgment the Prime Minister takes, every GG since at least 1952 has been the appointment, the decision, the final decision of the Prime Minister, who is then given the advice to the British monarch. So actually, I don't, I think Madame Arbour is like an exceptional, shockingly exceptionally good choice. So I'm very happy about that. But I actually agree with Duff about process. I think that we should have a process that's more open and inclusive. I don't know if I agree 100% with Democracy Watch's particular recommendation, but I look at what other democracies like Germany or Italy or Israel do when they choose a president. Which is very much akin to, in their systems, what our governor general is. It's a head of state role, but generally not a political or partisan role. And what they do is they have the government, in some cases, presents a list to parliament, and parliament votes on them. But that's how we elect. I mean, it's sort of how we elect a Speaker of the House. There's no list presented, but a Speaker of the House is elected by members of Parliament in a free vote. And so I would have no problem with doing that. I think it would give the office of the Governor General even more relevance and legitimacy. And frankly, as you know, Libby, I think it would be a great step as we move inexorably in this country to replace the monarchy. You know, that's my view. We should get rid of the monarchy, which is a terribly dated and undemocratic institution, not to mention a foreign one. And that by moving towards sort of a selection of a head of state along those lines, along the lines of other democracies, I think would be a positive thing, much better than a directly elected head of state in a parliamentary system, because then we'd end up with, the worst of all worlds. So I think Duff makes some relevant points, but I guess I would just finish by saying I don't think that Prime Minister Carney is like particularly guilty on this front, or that this is somehow, that it's not in keeping with previous appointments. I think it's very much in keeping with the style of selection in the past.
You mentioned moving away from the monarchy. So she was apparently asked, Duff, if she's a monarchist, and she gave a legalistic answer. I mean, she's appointed by the king, but it sounds like maybe she doesn't even believe in having a monarchy.
Yeah, and I think she was trying to remain very neutral because, of course, as the Bloc Québécois leader expressed, they in Quebec, they very much, more than other parts of Canada, want the monarchy ended in Canada and don't want to have and recognize the Governor General as a representative of the British Crown. So I think she was walking the fine line there. Democracy Watch has a very simple proposal of how we could change the protocol. The Prime Minister mentioned he asked King Charles for approval. And if he just didn't ask for approval, just said, this is our Governor General, and then King Charles said fine, then the protocols change and no longer is approval needed. It's just essentially giving notice. And that could be done without changing the Constitution at all. And it would, in some ways, Canadianize. It would be a small, somewhat symbolic step, but it would Canadianize the position. And then, as Peter's mentioned, other examples, we should democratize as well the selection. And I'm very disappointed that Mark Carney, knowing about this proposal and others that, and calls for this, didn't take any steps, but just used an even more secretive and handpicked and partisan process than either Trudeau or Harper used for choosing the new governor general. And it's a real step backwards by him.
I'm going to read a text from Janice, and she said, Louise Arbour is next door to perfect. Nothing wrong with the appointment. It should be the prime minister's decision. It should be the prime minister's decision. Both of you disagree and think that there should be input into it. I'd like to just turn to this question of age. The one good thing that we here see, I mean, she's 79 years old. She's embarking on a 5-year term, and we say that looks good. Peter.
Yeah, I mean, we used to think of Georges Vanier and Vincent Massey as old geezers, and she's probably older, assuming office than they were. But that shows, I mean, listen, today's 79 isn't what 79 was in 1960. And so we're living longer. People are more vibrant longer. I've also been pointing out in other interviews, she's the same age as Donald Trump. And that's all they have in common, because in every other way, she's the antithesis of his depravity. She's spent a career of public service in Canada and abroad, and he's just been lining his own pockets and stirring up hate. But that's an aside. So, yeah, I think that clearly, I mean, 79 is not what it was even a decade ago. So, yeah, she seemed like in pretty good shape yesterday. She's still got a full tank of gas. Listen, my former boss, Mr. Chrétien, is 92, and he's still going strong. I was with him a couple of weeks ago, and he's still going at it. So, you know. It's, I don't know if it's a state of mind, but these things are relative.
Yeah, I'd like to read a text from Joe, who disagrees with Janice, and he says, the Liberals should have a vote to select the governor general position, not selected by Carney. And I guess that echoes what both of you have been saying. She is a jurist. She's a lawyer. So that might help her when it comes to constitutional questions about prorogation, Doug. So I guess that's one good aspect.
Yes, I would not, though, just to be clear, Democracy Watch's position, and Peter made it clear as well, his position is not to have a direct election. If you had a direct election, you would not be able to prohibit under the charter people running on under a partisan banner. And then you can have a split which other countries suffer from when the prime minister is from one party, the president from another. What we're proposing is that ruling party leaders would choose all party leaders across the country, because the governor general also appoints the lieutenant governors in each province. All the party leaders recognized in the legislatures across the country would choose from a short list using a ranked ballot system. And that would be a multi-partisan system. People would not be running publicly under a partisan banner. You want to have this person viewed, appear to be nonpartisan and actually be nonpartisan. And again, that's the problem with the ruling party prime minister choosing the person. People can quite legitimately say, oh, he's chosen a lapdog for our guardian, our constitution, not a watchdog, because he got to handpick the person. And that shouldn't even be possible to say. So you need to change the process. It's not about Louise Arbour, the person. She, as you mentioned, is a former Supreme Court Justice, first former Supreme Court Justice being named Governor General, very experienced lawyer, knows the issues, and that's great to have someone who is required to uphold the rule of law and constitutional law in that position with the experience to do it. It's about the process, though. She's tainted with partisanship, and that's a mistake.
Peter, I'm going to give you the last word on this.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I broadly agree with Duff about moving forward, but I don't think that she is in any way tainted by the process, to be honest. I would prefer a process that was more open because I think over the long term helps wean us away from the British crown. But I think she's a great choice, and I don't see her. Listen, she's no puffball to anybody, and that would include the prime minister. She understands the roles, the constitutional obligations of governor general, probably better, certainly as well, if not better, than any of the previous office holders. So I think this is a good move for Canada, and I wish her the best of luck.
Okay.
If I could just say one other thing quickly.
Sure.
One of the problems with the position is she points to unwritten rules that people can argue about what they mean because they're unwritten. And all these rules should be written down, as Britain, New Zealand, and Australia have done, so the governor general can clearly say this prorogation's wrong, this snap election's wrong, this is what a vote of confidence is. The governor general needs written rules in order to be able to do their job properly, and they should have been written down long ago.
Okay. Thank you both so much, Duff Conagher and Peter DiNolo. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Okay. We're taking another break. When we come back, we've been talking a lot about generational divides lately, and it turns out there is a generational divide when it comes to traveling to the U.S. We'll talk about it when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we've been talking about generational issues, and there is one emerging when it comes to travel to the United States. It seems that the younger generations are more interested in taking trips stateside, while older Canadians are pulling back or continuing to pull back, as we have been since the latest tariff war. So new findings from the Travel Health Insurance Association of Canada's 2026 Smart Travelers Survey show that two-thirds of Canadians are planning to travel this year, and nearly two-thirds of Gen Z, younger people, say the U.S. is on their itinerary, and that is well ahead. Less than half of millennials say that, a quarter of Gen Xers, and only 14% of boomers say they'd consider going to the U.S. So right now, let's go to Will McAllier, and he is with the Travel Health Association of Canada. Hi there. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me in today. Appreciate it.
Okay. So I find this interesting. What do you think is behind it?
Well, it could be a few things, but clearly that generational divide, we've seen that shift now for, it's got to be about 16 months. We've seen a general drop off in travel to the U.S., but the younger folks are willing to take a look at that. And it could be a cost issue and it could be a convenience issue, right? It's much easier just to hop in the car and travel down to the U.S. And in some cases, you might be able to do so rather than flying, right? As opposed to going further destinations, sun destinations through the Caribbean, or even to what we're seeing as one of the big winners of Canadian travel, certainly as it relates to spring and summer, which is Europe.
Oh, yeah, is definitely Europe. Now, I'm wondering about the 14% of boomers. So I'm a boomer, and a lot of us resolved not to go to the States, but I know a lot of people who do, especially if they have commitments or property, especially in Florida, they haven't stopped at all.
Well, yeah, and we've certainly seen some folks, you bet, we're going to go down because we've got the place. But we've also seen a lot of sales of properties, of secondary properties, whether it be in southern Florida or some of the other states that have been up and certainly reported in the news. Southern Florida, a lot of Canadians trying to sell property down there. While it might not be the best time to do that, it's certainly something that Canadians are really, you know, peering to take a real stance on as a result of not feeling welcome down in down stateside.
Yeah, but it is selling your property now easier said than done.
I think that's what some are finding. So they're taking a really pragmatic approach to it. And some, yeah, of course they're going to travel if they've got that place down there. But I think, you know, ultimately what we're seeing in the data, and it's now a prolonged time, is that some of those patterns that we've seen and the friendships that have been created over those years is really starting to change the overall view of travel and what is acceptable, what isn't acceptable for Canadians, particularly as they get into the to our older ages into travel.
So tell me what you mean by that. The relationships are the relationships that people have in Florida frayed. I mean, I actually from friends, I've heard like some disturbing stories. They park somewhere while they're on their way back or forth and they get their car keyed because it has a Canadian license plate or somebody says something. But I don't know how widespread anything like that is.
Yeah, we've been hearing stories and maybe not quite as dramatic as actual physical damage, but certainly stories where individuals are identified by oftentimes their license plate and, you know, direction around, and maybe it's because of the media that's being consumed down there, but a real approach to, again, just not feeling welcome. And from what we're seeing in the data, it would appear as if Canadians are going to say, well, wait a second, maybe we're just not going to spend our dollars there. The winter is one story, right? The winter with a need for sun destinations, where we started to see more and more Canadians go to familiar destinations like Mexico and other parts of the Caribbean, Dominican Republic being a large one. But look, we've also seen a number of disruptions over this winter season, whether that be Cuba, areas related to Venezuela, as well as parts of Mexico. So exactly what that's going to reshape into come next winter is going to be a real, real interesting thing. But what we're seeing out of this survey specifically is a desire to travel, yes, but clearly a generational divide between what's acceptable and not as far as those destinations.
Now, speaking of Cuba, we have a text from Joe, and he says, Canada should make Cuba its 11th province. Well, we have territories, Joe. So seniors would have a place to go during the winter, not the USA. But as Will, as you pointed out, big problems in Cuba from the United States, limited electricity. I wouldn't have wanted to be there.
Fuel shortages as yeah. Well. And I think, you know, this is the type of discussion that sort of comes up similar to one that we would have annually around daylight savings time. And there have been discussions over the years, of course, around having closer ties with certain Caribbean countries. I don't know if there's been one around Cuba per se, but certainly some of the other smaller countries down there and having that relationship. And I certainly think a lot of Canadians would welcome that in the winter months, you know, the ability to have currency and healthcare follow them to some of those destinations. But it's an interesting discussion and one that we would probably take quite a lot of time exploring and thinking about.
I'm looking at your breakdown of the generations, and one of the things we've seen more of lately is intergenerational travel.
Yeah, and I think, you know, wanting to go down and explore, you know, various locations has been one that's been with us, and we've seen it certainly in the insurance world and making sure that coverage is afforded to both, you know, the grandparents as well as the grandchildren if they're taking them down. There are still going to be draws, right? We are still connected to the U.S. So even though travel patterns are changing, there's still a lot of individuals going down, particularly multi-generational, whether it's because of ownership or maybe it's the lure and attraction of some of the theme parks, right? The popular theme parks where those experiences are certainly something that are cherished And, you know, sometimes Canadians are going to be willing to look the other way on political decisions in order to continue to have those.
Do you see a kind of fatigue? I know that lately I've been asked, like, would you be willing to now go to New York? They don't support Trump in New York. And because we've been, you know, refraining from going to the States, certainly I have, for a long time. So do you see this kind of waning, people just getting tired of it?
It's interesting. Our last survey that we did, when we look at that generational divide, the percentage of Gen Zs going has actually increased, and those in the boomer section have actually decreased. So it seems as if it's sort of been entrenched on both sides of that equation, to the point where it may not be getting better, but in fact, a little bit worse, probably a couple of percent worse in terms of the willingness for boomers to go down to the States. However, when we position that close to some of the things we hear from, for instance, grocer associations about the Buy Canadian movement and how that's starting to wane, and in particular, as the price increases start to justify. And I think they had cited about a 10% factor. So I think the same can be true for travel. So as we start to see, you know, maybe some of the pains around the reduced travel, and should things start to go on sale more in the States. So for instance, destinations, we started to see them a little bit in the winter. Las Vegas feeling some of that, and some casino operators offering at par discounts to Canadians, including casino chips, might I add. It's interesting, and whether or not Canadians will still withstand that with all of the pressures related to affordability and cost of living, yet to be seen.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, Will McAleer. Bye-bye.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. That is all the time we have for Fight Back for today. Follow us on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram. I'll be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.